March 1999. The tranquility of a guerrilla trekking camp deep in the Ugandan impenetrable forest is shattered by a blitz attack that leaves many dead and dozens of tourists missing. 24 years on, there is still no justice for the victims of the Bwindi massacre or their families, and many of its perpetrators escaped justice. Primary sources for this episode include The Guardian, The Chicago Tribune, The Associated Press, ABC Australia, Uganda Safaris, Bwindi Impenetrable Park, The New York Times, and The Washington Times. Hi guys, welcome back to episode 157 of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. I hope you're all doing really well. I just want to welcome a few new patrons. So new patron Monica L, Laura L, and Taryn R, but I'm also going to say Taryn just in case it's one or the other. And I also want to welcome new existing patrons who upgraded to annual membership, Rochelle and Tia. Thank you. And also thank you for your contributions, Mariana and Aniko. I did write back to you, Aniko. I think that's how you pronounce it. So thank you so much. I do have a quick update before we get into this week's episode on an existing case we've covered, and I did an update episode recently, just a short one. The Toy Accordingly case, the Australian girl murdered on a beach up in Queensland a few years back, way too many years ago really, but finally we have some movement, the most movement that's happened in ages, and that is that the person who's alleged to have killed Toya, who also went on the run the next day back to India and was missing until a few months ago when someone finally handed him in when a reward was offered. Things are moving very quickly. He has been extradited back to Australia and arrived back on our sunny shores to face, hopefully, justice just a few days ago, which is great news. Toya's family is amazing, and I bet they're over the moon about all this movement. Of course, he says now that he was a witness to the crime, so he had to flee the country. So that's a story that's ever-changing, much like last week's case, you know, just changing story to fit the evidence. And his family also says, no, he's a good boy. He would never do this. He's innocent, and we're looking forward to seeing him in India again. So we'll see, but I'll keep you posted. So for this week's case, we were way overdue to go back to Africa. I checked, and the last time we went to Africa for a case was episode 127, the Ali Warren case, which was an Australian girl murdered while she was volunteering in Mozambique. And it's not for lack of trying that I don't do many Africa cases. It's purely when you put together an episode, the coverage of cases that happen there, it's just not there. There's not enough. I had another episode planned actually for this episode for patron Richard, and I tried to put it together. I've had him, this guy, on my list for 2 years, and I just couldn't. It would have been like a 10-minute episode. People go missing all the time. Groups go missing, and there's just no international coverage, which is, you know, what you unfortunately have to rely on. So when I try to put something together, often it's just not there. And I came up against something very similar with this one. Unfortunately, I had to scrape together information from all these different sources, and some don't even mention certain people's names. Others do. It's all kind of very scarce on details because the world media did not travel to Uganda to cover this. They were purely basing it on a couple of stringers from the Associated Press on the ground in Uganda. And it was 24 years ago, so pre-internet and pre kind of 24-hour news cycle. So when I asked patron Richard, who came on ages ago, months and months and months and months, Richard D, I asked him, as I do with everyone who comes on board at a specific tier, I asked him to pick a location and or a case, and he asked for a particular case that I did not have on my list. I had similar kind of mass abductions, usually in Africa or South America, but I did not have the Uganda tourist murders in the Bwindi National Park on my list. And so he requested it. Richard is from London. He currently lives in the city of Norwich. But he said to me, quote, "But I lived in Uganda for ages and travelled for a few years up through Africa, the Middle East, Nepal and India before working in travel for 8 years, mostly India and Nepal. Now I'm in a city called Norwich, which I reckon is one of the less interesting in the UK," which, you know, I've heard it's a pretty city. There's a cool, I know a few people who went to uni there. So he said, "You've done Uganda before, though the 1999 tourist murders there would be a good one for you to take a look at if you've not come across it yet. It's pretty brutal and issues that have not gone away, in my opinion," unquote. Which is true. And it was the first time I ever told someone what case I was doing before I actually did it, because I said to Richard, I've decided to go with this one, even though you gave me a couple of other locations like India to choose from. And he kind of said, it's a really brutal case. And these days, he said, he made a good point, it would be considered a terrorist attack. But this is really widespread use of the word terrorism. So it really wasn't. It was just considered a massacre, as it's usually covered or called in coverage. So we have been to Uganda before, way back on episode, I believe it was episode 29, for one of my favourite episodes I've ever done, the John Brisker case, which I've referred to a couple of times since. But it's still one of my personal favourites of Unknown Passage history, because it was an area that really fascinated me that I felt like a lot of people did not know about. And afterwards, people said they'd never heard of Idi Amin, you know, one of the worst dictators in world history, one of the worst people to ever walk the earth, you know. And so that was super interesting to me. In that episode, I discussed a bit about Uganda, which I won't be repeating on this episode, including the lead up to and what led to the dictatorship of Idi Amin in the 70s. I played clips of him talking. I talked about his expulsion of certain races from Uganda. And throughout that, the common thread was the story of John Brisker, who is a still missing African-American ex-NBA player who appears to, by all accounts, have gone to Uganda to potentially fight on the side of Idi Amin. There's so many questions in that case, and we honestly don't know. It's a fascinating case. But if you want to hear more about Uganda and that part of its history, you need to go back way back and listen to episode 29. But this case won't touch on Amin. It takes place, you know, 20 years after Amin's rule ended, almost exactly. It actually, 3 days ago was the 24th anniversary of, 2 days ago was the 24th anniversary of this happening. It takes place 20 years after Amin, and it takes us to a new area of Uganda to discuss other border issues that we have and that are still going on today, as Richard rightly pointed out. This case takes place 2 decades after Amin, but obviously the fallout from Idi Amin is still deeply entrenched in Ugandan history. They're really suffering with tourism. I was watching a documentary about just the death of tourism in Uganda, and that is why the gorilla tourism, G-O-R-I-L-L-A, not the other gorilla, is so important to the Ugandan tourist trade. And in my opinion, they do an incredible job, not only of protecting the mountain gorilla species, which I'm super passionate about, just animal welfare in general, but I love gorillas, I love orangutans, I love monkeys, but this is a big element to me. I love all primates. I'm fascinated by them. When I was growing up, the movie Gorillas in the Mist was one of my favorite movies, and I actually have had, since the start of this podcast, the story of Diane Fossey on my list to do, and I have to do it this year. She was who Sigourney Weaver played in the movie Gorillas in the Mist. She was basically an advocate to try to help the gorilla population in nearby Rwanda, the mountain gorilla population. Unfortunately, she was murdered, and that movie tells her story. And she worked closely with gorillas. She's much like Jane Goodall. She kind of lives and breathes it and gave her whole life to that in the truest sense of the word. And she was murdered, and she knew that she was in danger. And I really have to tell that story. So what I want to say is, I will talk about gorillas more as a species when I do Diane Fossey, because it ties in more with that. The reason that these tourists were in Uganda in March 1999 was to go on a gorilla trek, which is one of the most central tourism components of Uganda and keeps a lot of communities going. So I'll touch on them, but I won't go too much into detail, and I would go crazy, and I will on the Diane Fossey episode, talking about gorillas and primates. Visiting gorillas in Uganda is on my bucket list. It has been for years, but for me, when I think about this, I think about one of my favorite shows ever, which many of you love, An Idiot Abroad, where Carl Pilkington, I think it's season three, he goes to Uganda to see the silverback gorillas, and he has to trek, and he's bitching and moaning about it. And Carl Pilkington is one of my favorite people. And that show, honestly, as much as it's silly and everything, it really opens up some real aspects of tourism to people and the real reality of certain places. I particularly love the India episode from season one, I believe. And it's just such a great show, still worth watching, with Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant and Carl Pilkington. But unfortunately now, I think that memory is replaced for me. I will always think of this case. So thanks, Richard. So seeing them in their natural habitat is such an incredible experience that not many people will get to experience. And it would be a massive thrill for me. I follow an orphan animal. It's called CARE, Primate Care. It's in South Africa. They do work with orphaned animals, the victims of poaching where their mothers are killed. And I honestly like the work that they do. I follow various other rescues. I could talk forever about the work that they do and how much I've learned about different primates and monkeys. And I can never look at them not like us, because, you know, they share 98% of our DNA. So what happens when similarly minded people do the same in an area considered to be mostly safe, despite ongoing conflicts with nearby border countries? And then what happens when many of them are kidnapped and completely butchered in the worst ways possible due to a conflict they probably had no knowledge of and absolutely no direct involvement in? This story is the stuff of nightmares, and it took me back to the episode I did on the 1990s abductions and murders of hikers in Kashmir. Just a group of like-minded people not hurting anyone who became essentially political pawns, and this is still going on today. It's an unfortunate thing that can happen and that people who are travelling need to be aware of. The Bwindi National Park Massacre, as it has come to be known over the last two decades, is a terrifying, extremely violent story that isn't well known enough. And as Richard rightly pointed out, today's terminology, if it happened today, it would be classified as a terrorist attack. But then it wasn't. But the setting for such brutality is a pristine, beautiful part of the world that few will get to experience firsthand. And this event, as much as it just passed the 24-year anniversary, it affected so many different countries that's why the coverage is all over the place. And so many countries want their pound of flesh in regards to answers for citizens of their countries who were killed or were victimized. And I'll get into all of that on part two, which will be out in like 4 days probably. This takes us to a place called the Bwindi Impenetrable Park. This forms part of the Bwindi Impenetrable National Forest. And the term Bwindi, which I did look it up, some people don't pronounce the B, but most people pronounce the B, so I'm going with that. Bwindi literally means, in the native language, impenetrable. So it's essentially like saying the impenetrable national park. Located in southwestern Uganda, in the Kananga region of Uganda, is the Bwindi Impenetrable National Park. This is about 8 hours' drive from the Ugandan capital, Kampala, where much of the John Brusca case surrounded. This part of Uganda in the southwest is located near the border with a couple of countries that have had their fair share of troubles, and that's an understatement. It is located near the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo, which I'll just refer to as the Congo from now on, and also Rwanda. And its mountain gorilla population is actually on all three sides, although most people choose to visit them in Uganda because it's the most politically stable country to visit them from, although it's cheaper to see them on a tour in Congo, which I wouldn't recommend at the moment, especially, or Rwanda, which had its own civil war, you know, in the 90s. The Democratic Republic of Congo is a complex country we haven't been to yet. And this is why this is such a complex case, because the location where it happened in southwestern Uganda in 1999, it's so close to, you know, these two borders of two other countries, and all of them have their own serious issues and complex histories. And this is kind of the spillover effect. The entire Bawindi Impenetrable National Park spans over 300 square kilometres, or I believe it's around 32,000 hectares. It's a huge area, and its borders were officially established 8 years prior to this massacre in 1991. And since 1994, it has been a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The reason that it became kind of this established protected area was because mountain gorillas were seriously under threat. And this is something that really angers me, especially when it comes to poaching. Nothing boils my blood more than poaching or hunting for sport. It makes me sick. Don't ever let me near anybody who poses with a beautiful, majestic animal who has family and has a life of its own. I'm glad I've never come into contact with one of them, because I don't know what I'd be capable of, honestly. I just get so worked up. I'm already gritting my teeth talking about that. And to poach something that is 98% of our DNA, shares the same. And when you kind of learn about these species and see how they interact with their young, with people, how gentle they are with their young, how they have so many of the same characteristics as us, how they're so intelligent, to kind of deliberately poach them makes me fucking sick. So before 1991, for centuries, a local Indigenous pygmy people called the Batwa called the Bawindi National Park home. But in 1991, when it was established as this kind of World Heritage Site and it was going to be protected from logging and hunting and everything that the pygmies relied on it for, they were essentially evicted from the park and told to move elsewhere because it's surrounded by a lot of, there's like a few different Indigenous groups, and you can actually go and do like a stay with them. They're very friendly, but the Batwa were rainforest hunter gatherers, so they completely relied on the park. So this essentially like cast them out completely, which pissed off like a lot of people. But it wasn't government overreach, as far as I'm kind of concerned. Although I do have a major issue, you know, with casting out people who have lived there for centuries, like they're trying to do in the Amazon and things like that. It was purely because as I'll get into, the mountain gorilla population is so small. This national park has essentially like 3/4 of the world's population that are left. And so we need to protect these species. And they've done an incredible job of regenerating the population, as you can tell from the numbers. The national park is a nature lover's dream. You can absolutely see what drew these tourists in 1999 to this part of the world and why people continue to visit it. The diversity of its flora and fauna is truly beyond belief, and you can watch so many videos on YouTube of people visiting it. Unfortunately, a lot of them are clearly just travel influencers who are doing it for a free trip. They're playing doof doof techno music in the background. It completely just takes you away from the experience. Luckily, I found some really nice videos where people just, I wanted to hear the actual sounds of the park, the silence, where it's just the rain and the mist and the bird noises, and I wanted to see that, and I'll play you one that I found coming up, because that's truly the experience, and I'll get into a few thoughts I've had on that later. There's many endangered species within this park. There's 120 mammal species, over 300 bird species, over 300 butterfly species. There's frogs, there's chameleons, there's reptiles, there's geckos. It is positively humming with amazing creatures, an amazing plant species. And apparently when you go into it, it's really noisy, but it's the best kind of noise because it's the noise of life. It's the noise of, you know, the forest and all of these incredible species. Plus it's got tons of unique flowers, plants, trees. There's African elephants in the foothills. There's hogs, there's antelope, there's jackals, there's big cats. But it is the primates and particularly the gorillas of the Bwindi National Park that are the real draw card, especially internationally. Many species of monkeys and chimps live within its borders, and it's actually the only place in the world where these monkeys, chimps, and gorillas all live in the same areas. Like they've evolved to live together in harmony. Whereas there's a nearby national park that kind of spills over into Rwanda where they don't live like that. And they've tracked kind of how they live in the Bwindi National Park versus this one, I think it's called the Vanunga. And they live totally differently. Like they've evolved to the area that they live in. So the gorillas in the Bwindi, they survive a lot on fruit and kind of they're kind of become like herbivores in a way, and even their nests, how they make them are different. Whereas in the Vanunga one, they're a bit more unpredictable, I suppose. But as I saw one survivor of this attack say, you can generally predict animal behavior in these parts, he said, but the human aspect is what you can't predict, and that spills over into the events of this. There are 450 at the current census Bwindi gorillas that call the Bwindi National Park home, and these really capture the imagination of visitors and locals alike. The number is based on the most recent census in 2019, which kind of made me laugh because I was thinking, like, here when you do a census every few years, you fill out a form and stuff. That is not how they're doing it with the gorillas, because apparently gorillas can snap you clean in half just by picking you up. That's what I've read. So they kind of, there's like teams that constantly monitor them. And just a couple of years ago, two babies were born there and I was watching footage, two baby gorillas. And it's actually incredible, like, you know, the miracle of birth in general. But that's why it's such a big thing when an endangered species has, you know, a baby, like a white rhino or something that was born recently. In 1999, just to give you an idea of how much they're, sorry, 1997, so about 25 years ago, the population was around 300. And because none in the world live in captivity anymore, thankfully, of the mountain gorillas, this has gone up to 150. And it's not just like litters of kittens with gorillas. They're like us. So they can't just have a litter of, you know, like 1,000, you know, like 15 kittens or something. You know, gorilla babies are, it's a whole process. So it's gone up to 450, which is amazing. And the greatest threats to gorillas in this area have always been poaching, disease, and habitat loss. So the confines of the Bwindi National Park and how much they're protected by different government authorities mean that poaching does not happen. Disease is pretty much eradicated, and visitors to the area have strict guidelines they have to follow. And habitat loss essentially does not happen. So you've essentially eliminated the threats to the gorillas that they were living under. And now they essentially just live in harmony. And you can watch many videos of them just sitting there chilling, which I was kind of watching them thinking, I love gorillas and certain, you know, primates, but particularly gorillas. I love watching them because, and I often think this when I watch my cats, you know, how animals can just sit there and just, they're just thinking their thoughts and they're so still. And it's almost like humans have to learn mindfulness, and everyone's so highly strung and stress is through the roof. And then you look at certain animals in their natural habitat where they're not under pressure, they're not under threat, and visitors are very limited and it's very regulated. And they're just sitting there completely mindful, just chewing on a piece of grass, you know, sitting there. Then they just lay down. They look totally like they're in the moment. And I often think, like, we have a lot to learn from animals in terms of that. When they're not under stress, they're not, they know the confines of how their family unit works, how their group unit works, like gorillas do. They've got a hierarchical system and they're able to just live kind of in harmony. And so I often think that, you know, some animals just look completely mindful. And that's why I understand why people like Jane Goodall and even David Attenborough and Dian Fossey, the late Dian Fossey, decided to just spend their lives, you know, with these particular animals because they're incredible and they deserve our protection because humans are the biggest threat to these animals. These mountain gorillas, including the famous silverback gorillas, are so important because the population in the Bulwindi National Park make up more than half of the world's mountain gorilla population. They live in groups, they're highly intelligent, and they are truly amazing. And I was reading a study recently, just out of my own interest a couple of months ago, about how they've been able to study how gorillas essentially have the same, and a lot of primates, they have a lot of the same emotions as us because obviously they share so much of the same DNA. And they've been able to show, you know, which is clear in their interactions with their babies, that they feel immense grief, especially when they die or they're sick or something, how they interact and hold babies, how they help in their communities to raise babies, which I've learned a lot about through following this care primate group in South Africa. They often adopt, they integrate orphan babies into, like, I've watched, she kind of explains that you can follow them on social media. They match them with like a surrogate mother essentially and slowly integrate them into being with the surrogate mother and how much they accept them, because the surrogate mother is often a monkey in that instance who has lost its young, and so it's often grieving the loss of its young and is kind of, its mood just elevates so much when they give it a baby to look after. How they hold them, it's so much like how humans hold babies. There was that viral clip recently where a woman at a zoo, which is not ideal for these, unfortunately, was showing through the glass a gorilla, her new baby, her newborn, and the gorilla is showing her newborn, you know, because they feel pride. But also in this study that I was reading, it found, you know, they feel so many of the same emotions. They feel betrayal within their groups. They feel low self-confidence, high self-confidence. They feel shame. And they also feel envy, you know, and especially this is when a mother will lose her young through an accident or poaching or something. They feel this immense grief, but they'll also lash out at other women, with other females within the group who have their own babies, and they'll often try to abduct them to fill that void. And it's just incredible. And in order and to poach something like that, it's essentially like killing a human. It's just, I'll never understand it. There's no excuse for me. I don't care. Money, whatever. Sport, absolutely not. Money, nah. Like, there's no excuse for it for me. So the park's districts are all kind of, there's 14 different districts of the park. There's four different districts of the park, and there's 14 distinct groups of gorillas that live together across the park's district that are accessible by tourism, and all fall under the Uganda Wildlife Authority. Uganda has taken huge strides to protect this population of mountain gorillas, and the numbers obviously speak for themselves. Trekking to see the gorillas in their natural habitats became a possibility in 1993. It boosted much-needed tourism. We're talking, this is only, you know, barely a decade after Idi Amin, where he essentially closed the country to everyone and expelled everyone. It boosted much-needed tourism to the region in the fallout of that, while doing a major service to the population as well. And it produced jobs. So people started coming, people started hearing about it, and people started kind of wanting to go and have these experiences that were off the beaten track, that weren't the typical tourist destinations. And this really helped the people of the towns and villages that surrounded the park, because these are considered some of the poorest people in Uganda. Before 1991, the park was essentially a free-for-all for logging and hunting and agricultural activities. But post-1991, that was no longer an option. And to stop this, the park was given higher protection. So it was regularly patrolled by guards. We will get into that more because that plays into this case. But locals, obviously, to the park and the surrounding cities, villages and towns that surround the park which is in the tens of thousands, the population were not happy because they relied so much on this park. And obviously they've adapted their behaviours over the last few decades to kind of work with that. The topography of the park is very rugged. Much of it is only accessible by foot. Otherwise, you're in like a four-wheel drive for parts of it, but you cannot get through, especially where the mountain gorillas are. You have to trek out. So you have to have a certain amount of physical fitness. It's really hard when you watch videos of people doing it. And I remember Carl Pilkington doing it and moaning the entire time. It's like a 14-hour trek. There's a famous line that Ricky Gervais says. He says it's accessible by a 14-hour trek. He's telling him before he goes, and he goes, but that's not accessible, is it? Which is actually a really good point. So it has peaks and troughs, it has visitors, rivers and streams, it has mountains and valleys, and 60% of the park is at an elevation of around 2,000 metres high. The peak rainfall, so the rainy seasons are, it starts in March, but it really amps up in April, and so it's March to April and then September to November. And this particular incident took place in the March of 1999, but I believe because it was the start of March, the 2nd of March, the rainy season hadn't fully come to fruition yet. And the climate of this part of the world is tropical. It's very kind of, even though it can rain and it's very misty, it's very humid. Tourist accommodations are at a place called the Bahoma Park, which is where part of our case essentially begins today. It's near one of the entrance gates to the park. It's kind of in the vicinity of the one local community hospital that services 40,000 locals. And back then in 1999, I believe, you can't get many really good pictures of it back then. There's a few videos from the Associated Press of the time and the fallout of the park. But when you look at the Bahoma Park today, which is the one accommodation for people visiting the Bawindi National Park, you stay at the Bahoma, and it's in the northern part on the border, like near the entrance gate. Today it's a bit kind of bougie. It's got, you know, a lodge, and it's got all these different cottages, and you can stay in like a tent, there's restaurants, and it's in very thick terrain. It's almost like when you look at pictures of it, these cottages like set into thick forest. Some of them are like on stilts, you know. It's in this really thick forest, and it's quite a sprawling park. And this was one of the things that I've really had to try to get a handle on, because I couldn't picture the events that I'm about to tell you about and where they were happening until I looked at pictures of the Bahoma Park, because I couldn't understand a couple of things, which I'll get into. But it was mainly I couldn't understand why the initial attack went for a couple of hours. And now I understand by looking at pictures, because it's a sprawling kind of park region where you can at any time have hundreds of people staying there, all from different tour groups, different nationalities. People were in tents. They're dotted all across. Some of them are like thick in the jungle portion of it. It's all very tranquil and lovely now. But I think in 1999, it was still kind of finding its feet. And now I understand, because there was clearly areas for people to hide, which is why the initial attack kind of took a while. So as gorilla tourism grew, gorilla, the animal, there was one headline that said, you know, gorillas scare tourists away, G-U-E-R-I-L-L-A-S, but gorillas, G-O-R-I-L-L-A, they draw them in. And I thought that was a really clever kind of headline. As gorilla tourism grew, it became more regulated to avoid damage to the area. Permits must be attained to join one of these trekking groups. And as much as there's quite a number of tour groups that run constant, you know, annual tours year round throughout this area, the Wildlife Authority only allows about 40 permits a day. And they've kind of taken the same route that the Inca Trail has taken in certain very heavily trafficked parts of the world, where you have to get a permit. Everest is the same. This is to avoid a lot of different things: degradation to the environment, disease being transmitted to the gorillas, which is strictly controlled here, just generally trying to retain the integrity of the park. So they your tour group that you go with, because you can't just go and do it on your own. This is much like Everest in a way. They organise your permits for you, but it's quite pricey to do this kind of activity because the permit itself in Uganda is about $700 to go and do this. Now, I was reading on one of the tour group websites in nearby Rwanda, which also kind of shares borders. My cats are beating the shit out of each other right now. They're like fighting like Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield, just to talk about the animal kingdom. In Rwanda, it's around $500 for a permit, and then if you do it from Congo, which they do not recommend, it's like $300 a permit, which would draw in people trying to save money, but they don't understand how dangerous it is to do it from Congo, which is why the people in these tour groups thought there's no issue because we're doing it from the safest border country, you know, Uganda. And the issues that were currently happening were in Rwanda and Congo on the other side of the border. And you think borders exist for a reason. No one can just kind of cross them over. But then you later find out that, as I did even today, you can cross borders in this part of Uganda into Rwanda and Congo and there's no border. You can just cross over. I was watching a YouTuber and she was just like, yeah, you can just cross over into Rwanda. And I was thinking, yeah, do you know what happened in 1999 and why you kind of need someone on that border or the various borders? I doubt she kind of knew. So according to followalice.com, who has done, she's a travel writer, but she's done the tour and talked about it extensively. Quote, in Bawindi, there are four gorilla tracking sectors and each sector issues no more than 40 permits per day, with most sectors issuing far fewer than that. Permits are issued in groups of eight, with each group being assigned to track and visit a specific gorilla troop, unquote. So it just depends on where you're going. It's to avoid you interacting too much with the gorillas, and when you do get to them after your long trek on the particular day you visit them, it's very quiet. You can't just go up and talk to them. You can be a couple of meters away, and mostly they don't even react to tourists anymore. They're probably just like, oh, fuck these tourists. Like, you know, they're just chilling. And I think that's totally fine, but it's very quiet. You don't want to kind of rile them up or anything. So the area's thick mist is evident in the title of the famous book by Diane Fossey that became a movie, Gorillas in the Mist. And this kind of constant mist is over the area, which gives it this kind of spooky feel, which I really thought a lot about when I was reading about the events of this case. Tour groups trek to see the gorillas in their native habitat. They spend about an hour watching them. It takes you deep into the forest, thick in mist, dense in dew, even if it's not raining. Its name, Impenetrable, or Bawindi, comes from the fact that parts of this are just the thickest vegetation you can imagine. So dense in bamboo and vines, something that would normally take in a car, even though you can't access it by a car. Like 15 minutes would take you, you know, 8 hours on foot in this part of the world. It is so hard to get through. And according to visitors, the sheer noise once you're deep in the jungle is so loud of, you know, birds and you know, primates and the rivers and the streams, and it's the sounds of life. You can access the Bawindi National Park from Kampala. You can drive 8 hours from the capital of Uganda. You can also fly from Kampala to another kind of more local, smaller airport, local to the Bawindi National Park, or you can start a tour group from Kigali, which is the capital of nearby Rwanda, and it treks into this part of the world. Mountain gorillas are not a species you will just get up close and personal with. They're extremely strong. As I've said, they're protective of their tribe, but they're mostly like placid in this natural environment where they know they're not under threat, and they've kind of evolved to get used to tourists coming in. And it's not just all day, every day tour groups. And the groups are no more than eight. It's usually around like, you know, four or five people. They're only there at a distance watching them for about an hour and then they go. That's why the tours are really quiet. They're led by local park rangers and experts, and they're short. The rest of your tour is generally made up with visiting the local indigenous groups. You can do homestays with them. They do treks out to see the monkeys. They do, butterfly treks. They offer all kinds of stuff. There is also a gorilla habituation experience that you can book if you want to spend longer with the gorillas. So these permits are even fewer. There's very few of them and they have to be booked like a year in advance. This allows you to spend 4 hours with the gorilla troop from a distance, totally learning everything from the local park rangers about their lives, habituation, everything. But it isn't just the gorillas that draw tourists here. Many tours also spend time with the local indigenous groups, particularly the Pakiga and the Batwa, which I talked about earlier, who were the people who were the pygmy people who were expelled from the Bwindi National Forest. The Batwa women, if you see pictures of them, they carry the giant water things on their heads. It's unbelievable. I don't even know how it's possible. Authorized tour groups today offer treks here. A quick Google will bring up the main major tour groups. There's one called Gorilla Trekking Uganda, who offer 4 or 5 day treks and wildlife safaris of the Bwindi National Park. Silverback Gorilla Tours also are a leading tour provider. Overall, tours will cost you in the vicinity of $1,500 to $5,000, depending on what kind of tour you book. You can also do day trips. But this does not include flights or anything like that. It's purely the gorilla trekking experience. So it's not cheap. And to consider that the permit itself is almost $1,000, that's why it has to be this amount. To give you an idea of how a day works on this trek, this is from Silverback Gorilla Tours, who are like a leading tour provider of the Bwindi National Park. And it will give you an idea of, in 1999, what the different tour groups were kind of expected to do when they were staying there. Quote, gorilla trekking in Bwindi Forest starts with a briefing at the park headquarters at around 7:30 a.m. Visitors should sleep early before the day of trekking and wake up by 5 a.m. to take breakfast before starting the journey to the park office. After the briefing at the park office, trekkers are separated into smaller groups of 8. Each group of 8 track a particular gorilla family. Some gorilla families live near the park offices while others are found further away. The park guides from the Uganda Wildlife Authority, 2 armed rangers and porters move with each group. The guides are very experienced, knowledgeable and well-trained. While leading tourists to the gorillas, they will share information about the gorilla family and other animals found in the forest. The time taken tracking gorillas in Bwindi depends on the gorilla group one is assigned to. It can take only 30 minutes to locate some groups while others can take hours. A team of trackers normally go ahead of the group to identify the location of the gorilla family. They then inform the lead guide by radio call of the exact location of the gorilla family. These advanced trackers know where the gorilla group built their last sleeping nests and will head to that direction. There is no guarantee of seeing the gorillas, but the chances of spotting them is over 98%. Once you spot the family, you will be allowed only 1 hour with them so that they don't start getting uncomfortable. Watching gorillas can be an extremely emotional event, as gorillas behave like humans and share about 98% of our DNA. Take your time to observe their behavior and different personalities while taking some great photos for your memories. Follow the rules and regulations for gorilla tracking, such as not smoking or eating within sight of the primates. Do not run away when a gorilla charges at you. Lie down with your heads down as a sign of submission, unquote. So that was a good way to wrap it up. But that's unlikely to happen unless they get aggravated. So from the time the park was established in 1991 to 1999, obviously word of this unique experience grew across the world. So by early 1999, tourists were coming from all over the world, the USA, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, mainland Europe. Many came as part of an existing African visit where they were visiting other countries in Africa and decided to make time for this. Others would come specifically just for this experience. Most, considering the cost, were serious tourists, eager to see this biodiverse part of the world and the wonder that lay within it. And the tours are regulated, strict, and led by armed guards and experienced game wardens, many of them local Ugandans. Issues in nearby Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, despite being close to their borders, were considered somewhat distant at the time. Tourists were still encouraged to experience Bwindi, albeit with, you know, an element of caution. After all, countries' borders exist, and you expect them to serve a purpose. For many on the tour in March 1999, maybe they didn't even know that over in Rwanda, where similar guerrilla tours were becoming more popular, tension had been brewing, you know, for decades. They'd had a Rwandan civil war. See the movie Hotel Rwanda for an introduction to that. Tensions were brewing at the, in 1999 as well, and that would embroil them in a multi-country disaster. More recently, Uganda had also been embroiled in ongoing violence. In the August of 1998, rebels had kidnapped 4 foreign tourists and 7 Congolese guides and porters on a trek to observe the guerrillas. This was Ugandan rebels. 3 of them, 2 Swedes and a New Zealander, were still missing at the time that the attack happened in March 1999. But the people, you know, and it's hard to get a read on how many exactly were there. That's one of the issues with this. I believe it was probably like 50 to 100 people at the Bahoma Lodge, at the Bahoma camping ground, or over 100. But most of them were not worried. Some of them were doctoral students from the USA, which I'll get into, who had been living kind of long-term at the camp while doing dissertations and theses and the like. Some people worked there full-time and so lived in kind of a more long-term accommodation part of the Bahoma camp. Others were just the short-term stay areas of the camp. And tourists were in and out all the time. These tours were led by armed game wardens. You would feel more secure knowing that they had, you know, guns, and the campsite was connected to, you know, it had two-way radios and things like that where you can immediately get help if you wanted. It wasn't located too far from the local hospital, you know, just a relatively short drive away if something was to happen, and that was why it was positioned where it was. The campsite was secure, and despite the lodgings in 1999 being pretty basic, you know, tents and what appears to be grass huts and things of the like, dozens of people of all kinds of nationalities were constantly in and out of it, and nothing had really happened with the Bahoma camp. So that's why March 2nd shook so many people across the world to their core. The Bahoma camp on the northern perimeter of the Bawindi National Forest is kind of dotted, as I talked about, over a bit of a kind of larger area. Here are tents, lodges, and all kinds of different accommodations, as well as restaurants and things like that today. It seems a lot more upgraded than it was, obviously. According to their official website, quote, Bahoma Guerrilla Camp is a spacious and eco-friendly mid-range facility in a forest patch 400 metres after turnoff to the Bawindi Community Hospital. 10 minutes drive to Bahoma Guerrilla Tracking Briefing Point in the northern sector of Bawindi Impenetrable National Park. So this is the one area where visitors to the park stay. And so you have to think about it like if you were scoping this place out or casing it, it wouldn't be hard to know exactly where there would be a large group of tourists at any one time. I felt the best way to tackle the story of this event that would affect hundreds of people in a massive fallout across so many different countries, and it's really hard to piece it together, to be honest, was to start with the testimony of a 30-year-old woman called Elizabeth Garland, who was an innocent victim of this, but fortunately would live to tell the tale. And on March 3rd, the day after this, her father spoke to the Chicago Tribune, as he had just spoken to Elizabeth, who was by then safe. So it was, this coverage is one day after the attack. Elizabeth Garland was a 30-year-old University of Chicago doctoral student. She was in Africa to study the impact of tourism on native people, so obviously the Bawindi National Park interested her. And she had been living on the Bahoma campground in a tent for a couple of months on the northern edge of the park. And the more long-term stay area was just a short trail away from the main lodging area where all the tourists were staying. And at this point, at the beginning of March 1999, it was full of tourists staying in all the various tents and such. So Elizabeth was just kind of doing her doctoral thesis and not interacting really with the tourists in that part of the park. But luckily for her, being a little trail distance away would ultimately save her life. On March 2nd, 1999 at around 6:45 a.m. and it was a Monday. Elizabeth Garland was asleep in her tent when she was awoken by the sound of gunfire and grenade explosions. According to her father, James Garland, quote, she dressed but did not leave her tent for fear that the noise of the tent zipper would attract attention. The gunfire and explosions continued until about 9 a.m. She could then hear banging noises as rebels kicked in doors on the ranger station and the guest huts for tourists and began looting, unquote. Now, I've thought about this so much. When Richard first requested this case, I looked at it because I couldn't kind of help myself. I plan them in advance, and when people request something as a patron, I add it to the list. I choose the case well in advance, and I often kind of go over the different ones I have on my list to do, and I generally do them in order, but I glance at them to see what they're about. And I've thought about it quite a lot in the last couple of weeks since I really started looking into it again, and this moment for Elizabeth Garland. And I thought about the kind of fight, flight and freeze response of people, how I've had quite bad anxiety throughout my life, but it's never based on an immediate threat to your existence, to your life. And most people, thankfully, will never get to experience that kind of, especially in a developed country. So I've had, you know, I get a nervous tummy, and, you know, my mum has always said women in our family get like the nervous poos. Like, I don't know how else to put it, but that's what she calls it, where your bottom, like your gut just bottoms out on itself from nerves and stuff. And I've had this throughout my life, sometimes just brought on by nothing, sometimes just brought on by having to present something at university back in the day when I had issues kind of with self-confidence and things. All kinds of different things, but none of them are generally like a threat to your very existence. And thankfully, I hope I'll never get to experience that. But this whole podcast is dotted with examples of that, where your threat to your existence, you know, is immediate. And Elizabeth Garland, you know, would never, when she went to bed the night before, ever think that what would wake her up in this tranquil, kind of calm environment where it would be so quiet right before dawn. She'd never think that what would wake her up would be such a jarring, adrenaline pulsing thing that would, essentially, your whole body would just go completely into overdrive. That's why people, you know, shit themselves when these things happen. Like, it's just an immediate, you know, biological response. People vomit, like, in the space of something immediately threatening their existence. And I thought quite a lot about that, you know. I mean, what would you do? I can just imagine Elizabeth kind of cowering in her tent. And people in these instances say they can, their heart is so loud that they're scared someone will hear it, you know, will find them. And you've got to think at 6:45 in the morning, people are not up yet. I read you a breakdown of what a day is like, and I read that for a reason. You're generally maybe up, or at this point on this particular day, they were not, most people, but they would soon be getting up. But you're in your night clothes, you don't have your shoes on. And then you're also in that kind of half asleep, half awake stage, which woke me up. An earthquake 2 years ago in Melbourne, like 5.8, woke me up in that phase. And I didn't know what the hell was happening. And it was shaking everything, and we never get those. And it took me a minute to realize what was happening because I thought I was dreaming it. And I was thinking, half these people, this is what's tearing them out of sleep. And you wouldn't know what it was, but you'd know that it doesn't fit with the environment that you're in, these noises. And long story short, I just can't imagine the fear. I can picture myself, and my whole body would go into like an overdrive, like vomit, you know, poo myself situation. And like anyone who survives that, you can see why people develop post-traumatic stress disorder. It's like serving in an active war zone, why so many people throughout the years have lived with that, you know, post-Vietnam, post, you know, World War One, post-World War Two, post-Afghanistan, you know, you can totally see why. And that's why it was called shell shock. For a reason. So Elizabeth Garland, you know, she dressed and she wouldn't leave her tent because she was scared to the noise of her tent zipper would draw attention to the fact that there were tents further down the trail from where these explosions were happening. And then We're talking like 6:45 to 9 a.m. it continued till. And she, it's hard to get kind of a breakdown of different survivors' accounts. A lot of them just never spoke to media or anything. A lot of them died. A lot of them were killed. A lot of them were in areas where they didn't see the initial attacks, and then they were kind of rounded up by these rebels. But she could hear the rebels kicking in the doors on the ranger station, the ranger station being where the radios are, and them setting fire to the ranger station and knowing that you can't get access to get help, and that was for a reason. And the guest huts kicking in the doors and screaming at people and looting and throwing grenades and setting fire to things. So Elizabeth sat like in fear in her tent until around 10 a.m. And she said an hour after the last grenade explosion, which was at about 9 a.m., she heard the camp manager call her name, and she left the tent and they walked around the area. And basically what they were met with was dead bodies, people who had been burnt to death, people who had been murdered. All the vehicles and buildings in the camp had been essentially burnt to the ground, and many of the tourists were missing. A number of them were dead in the camp, and they were trying to piece together what happened. They couldn't, they were like, who did this? Was it Ugandans? Was it locals? Was it, you know, people in Rwanda? Was it people in Congo? So luckily for them, they were able to find a two-way radio that had not been destroyed in this attack. And they contacted the US embassy that was located in Kampala, the capital of Uganda. And because this was an immediate threat to, you know, Americans, but also a number of other kind of nationalities, the embassy sent a plane to the nearby airstrip on the perimeter of the Bwindi National Park. And they were able to evacuate Elizabeth Garland and others who were able to be taken to Kampala, you know, for medical help or to get the hell out of Uganda. And the US State Department quickly issued a warning to Americans planning to visit Western Uganda, basically saying it's a code red, do not visit Uganda until further information becomes available. But they had no idea who had done this at this point, and where about 30 missing tourists were, who were staying in the camp to do their trek and were now no longer at the camp and were missing. And you can view various Associated Press videos. Obviously, I'm not going to play them for you because they've got no sound. It's just the Associated Press filming of the fallout of the initial attack on the camp, where they're walking around in silence, filming different parts where it's been, things have been burnt down, you know, things have been blown up. There's a car completely torched. Any way that you could get out of the park or to help, they had essentially kind of destroyed. So what had happened in the time that Elizabeth Garland sheltered in her tent, terrified, on that morning of March 2nd, 1999? As dawn broke over the tranquility of the Bahoma camp on March 2nd, 1999, hell had come to the sprawling camp. Over 100 men zigzagged out of the tree line, and the silence was completely shattered. Armed with guns, machetes and grenades, they launched a blitz attack on the Bahoma camp and all the people within it. They were hunting those staying there, immediately killing those who worked there, setting fire to all of the accommodations and cars, and destroying key things that could be used to alert others for help. Tourists' doors were kicked in and they were rounded up like cattle. Wardens and guards were hunted to dispose of them first. And according to Elizabeth, this terror went on for over 2 hours as they hunted tourists that were hiding out in their accommodations or trying to escape in the jungle, between 100 and 150 men, all armed with machetes and grenades and guns. And just kind of put yourself in that fear. It's one of the most terrifying things for me, this kind of thing. And you can see why Richard said, you know, it would be classified as a terrorist attack today. And so that's where I'm going to leave it for part one. Part two, we'll talk about, I don't give trigger warnings because it's a true crime show. Part two, we'll talk about the experiences of those who were kidnapped, what they saw. It is extremely brutal. So be warned. We'll also talk about those who took responsibility for this, the actions against them and why it happened and where they are today. I'll be back in like 3-4 days with part two. Thank you for listening. Join the Patreon. Thank you for those who have joined. AI is day by day taking my job and the job of many creators, writers for a living, and that's deeply upsetting. So thank you for joining the Patreon, because that really helps, because I know that people still want a human talking to them and telling them stories, and I can rely on that. So that's why, one of the reasons why I'm so glad I started this podcast when I did. Have a fantastic weekend as much as you can. And I will talk to you when I'm back. Thanks, guys.